Good morning, and welcome to another Tuesday edition of Community Conversations, playing as the morning show. At some point in time, Julie, we're going to get back together live in the studio with all of our interviewees. But for now, it's Phil Huff and Julie Calamine recording on Zoom.
Yes, we are. Hello, Phil. How are you doing this week?
Doing well. It's been a busy time as we slip into fall. The weather's getting cooler. The colors are turning and the mountain goats are playing hide and seek. I went up on Sunday and it was kind of a nasty, snowy, windy day and they were gone. But I had friends that went on both Saturday and Monday and saw lots of mountain goats, mountain goat kids on the top of Scotchman Peak.
Yes, I'm kind of dodging raindrops every time I go out also, Phil. So the rainy fall weather is coming, but you know what? I'm looking forward to it. We had a hot, dry summer and it's time for some rain and cooler weather. I'm thrilled. Yeah.
And I know what else you're finding. You probably don't want to share that. You don't have to share locations, but Julie brought back some wonderful chanterelles last week. It cooked up very nicely with a little butter and garlic over the weekend. Thank you, Julie.
Oh, you're welcome, Phil. Everybody's enjoying chanterelles. I've been sharing them around, so I'm happy that you enjoyed them.
The bounty of the fall.
That is so true.
So we're delighted today to bring a couple of guests into the studio that we're finally getting the chance to introduce to the community. As with many organizations, the Idaho Conservation League has had an office in Sandpoint now for, I think, going on 14 or 15 years and has had some new staff transitioning in the last year. So we're here today to talk with Ellie Hudson-Heck, a conservation assistant with the Idaho Conservation League, and Becca Rodak, the community engagement assistant. Good morning, Ellie. Good morning, Becca.
Good morning.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having us.
And we're going to ask you to separate your voices so listeners can identify you. So we're going to interview each of you with a couple of specific questions coming up. But Becca, why don't you start us off with telling us a little bit about the Idaho Conservation League, the organization's mission, and the work that they do up here?
Yeah, I would love to. Happy to be on here with y'all. So the Idaho Conservation League is a statewide conservation organization. Our largest office is in Boise, but we have three other offices in Ketchum, here in Sandpoint, and then our newest office is in McCall, which just opened in March. We've been around since 1973, and we work to protect Idaho's environment. So much of our work falls under four major campaigns, which are protecting public lands, combating climate change, restoring Snake River so that it's swimmable and fishable, and then restoring salmon and steelhead populations. Basically, we want to protect the things that make Idaho, Idaho. Idaho is a unique state. It's known for being kind of wild, which I think is something a lot of Idahoans take pride in. So we want to make sure that the things that make Idaho so great and the things we all love, our lands, our water, and our wilderness, are things that are being protected for us and future generations.
Yeah, that's a great mission. And we're going to hear more about that shortly. Now I'd like for you both to tell us a bit about yourselves and how you came to be at ICL. And let's just start with you, Becca.
Sure. I love that question of how I like found myself here, because sometimes it's really surprising that I live in Idaho and I get to live in Idaho and I get to work to protect Idaho's environment. So I grew up on the East Coast. I'm from Pittsburgh. My whole family is back there, and then found my way to Idaho by way of AmeriCorps, which, if you're not familiar, it's like the Peace Corps, but in America. So I signed on for a service year with some nonprofits in Boise. And then knew that I wanted to work for the Idaho Conservation League, knew that I wanted to work to preserve the environment, because that's why I fell in love with Idaho, because it just felt more wild and like there was a lot of exploring still to be done here. So applied for the job and then moved my way up to Sandpoint and found it to be an amazing community, very tight-knit community. And I think what I've loved about working with nonprofits in Idaho is just that you can tell that the people I've met and the people I've worked with, they're really invested in making their communities better in any way they can.
And so you're the conservation, community engagement assistant. So tell us about what that means. What does that entail?
Yeah. So my region is kind of the panhandle. So Bonner's Ferry down to about Riggin. So a little more than the panhandle, a wide region. So basically, I look for opportunities for communities to get involved in advocacy and engagement. So building our conservation community, building relationships, finding partner organizations. And especially I'm interested in reaching out to those folks who might be newcomers to the conservation world. might not be as familiar with the issues, and finding ways we can broaden our audience and broaden those stakeholders.
And tell us a little bit about your background. How did you acquire the skills and interest in this?
Sure. My background is in communications. I went to the University of Pittsburgh and have a bachelor's in communications. And I knew I wanted to work with nonprofits. So I went through AmeriCorps. I worked with Corpus Christi House and did outreach, communications, and services coordination with them. They're a daytime homeless shelter. And then I worked with the Women's and Children's Alliance in Boise as the outreach coordinator and then as a communications coordinator. So those skills helped me in this job as well, reaching out to people, communicating, engaging.
Yeah, and did you start in Boise and then work your way to Sandpoint?
Yeah, so I had those two positions through AmeriCorps in Boise, and then this position with ICL opened up in Sandpoint and just decided that I was ready for the next new thing, ready for a new adventure, and moved myself up here.
Very nice. Well, that's a great introduction, and I'm happy to have heard a little bit about you and your background, and welcome to the Idaho Panhandle, Becca. And now we'll go ahead and hear from Ellie. Ellie, tell us a bit about yourself and how you came to be working in the local office here in town.
Hi, everyone. Awesome to be here. I'm excited to talk with everyone today. So I'm the conservation assistant for our North Idaho office. And really, even though I'm in the North Idaho office, my job kind of has a statewide focus. So I'm on our programmatic team, and my background is in water quality. And so a lot of my work is focused on water quality and air quality throughout the state of Idaho. About 50% of my job is more regulatory focused. So I review a lot of the water quality and air quality permits that are released by the state. And then I also attend statewide water quality and air quality rulemakings that the state puts on. And then about the other 50% of my job is focused on water quality issues within Northern Idaho. And so that's things like the Kootenai River selenium issue and the water quality issues on Lake Coeur d'Alene. And so in terms of, that's kind of what I do now. And in terms of where I come from, I come from a pure science background, really. I just completed my PhD recently in chemical oceanography. And so I come from a pure water science background. And about halfway through my PhD, I kind of realized that I didn't necessarily want to be the one doing the research and doing the science. I wanted to be the one using it and implementing it into policy. And so that kind of brought me out to Idaho and with the Idaho Conservation League. And I think it's a perfect position to be able to use science, but to not have to be the one doing the science and to be working with people that are just interested in learning about environmental issues in Idaho and getting to help them connect with and be a part of that process.
We always ask folks who are new or relatively new to share their long bridge moment. And I suspect you both understand what that means. So Ellie, why don't you keep, since you've been talking, keep talking. Tell us about your long bridge moment.
Yeah, that it really is an aha moment, huh? That is just such a mesmerizing moment. But I will say actually that I think my long bridge moment was kind of a question mark, because once I heard the long bridge, I automatically assumed there was also a short bridge, and that's not that's not a thing. And so I'm still curious to this day why it's called the long bridge. And I
leave it to a scientist to dissect and take the fun out of it.
I guess I did take the fun out. I'm sorry.
Becca.
Oh my gosh. I love this question. So that was the first, I had never been to Sandpoint before deciding to move here. My first time seeing the Long Bridge was realizing that I was going to live here permanently. I was going to be here full time. So crossing that bridge and seeing the mountains on the other side and seeing a little bit of the town, I think I said out loud, just like, holy crap, over and over to myself in the car as I was driving across that bridge. And then after I got across the bridge and into town, I immediately called my mom and I was like, I just crossed the most beautiful bridge in the whole world. And then I took a video of the town. Oh my gosh. And then I, since being here, I've asked people, like, does that ever get any less awesome? Like crossing the bridge and seeing that you're coming towards Sandpoint? And everyone has said no. Like, it's always that amazing.
I've been here for 19 years, 19 and a half. And still, even this morning, I crossed Long Bridge with a certain amount of awe and wonder and excitement that, hey, I get to be here.
Yes, I'll agree, but with one qualification: getting onto the Long Bridge some mornings is not as much fun as But anyway, now I'm really digressing. So, guys, let's come back around and talk about the Panhandle projects, and I'm really interested in hearing about the Kootenai River Selenium issue. Tell us what that is about and what you're working on.
Sure, I can take that one. So one of the main issues that Becca and I both really focus on is the Kootenai River Selenium issue, how we refer to it. And to be honest, it's really a complex kind of multi-layered issue because it involves multiple different states and two different countries, Canada and the US. And so in a gist, what's happening is that in Southeast British Columbia, there are five mountaintop removal coal mines that are owned and operated by a mining company called Teck Coal. And mountaintop removal mining is really exactly what it sounds like. Big mining companies come in and they literally remove the top of a mountain and then mine the remaining parts for coal. And so because of the way that Teck mines for coal, Teck ends up releasing large amounts of selenium pollution into the Kootenai River watershed. And selenium, if you're not familiar, it's what I like to refer to as a Goldilocks element. So too little amount of selenium is not enough, and too much is really toxic. And really, you just need the perfect amount for survival. And that's for species like fish and also for humans. We need selenium as well. And so unfortunately, what's happening is that selenium pollution kind of trickles down through Southeast British Columbia and enters Montana through Lake Coconusa. And then eventually that pollution winds up in the Kootenai River in North Idaho. And so unfortunately, we're seeing levels in this watershed that are kind of reaching those more toxic levels that I was talking about. And so we're already starting to see some real catastrophic effects that are happening in this watershed on the Canadian side. Recently, and I shouldn't say recently, in 2017, the population of West Slope cutthroat trout decreased by 93% because of that selenium pollution. And so some of those signals are already happening on the Canada side of this watershed. And so right now, ICL and Becca and I are trying to focus on kind of garnering enough attention and importance on this issue now so that we can prevent those catastrophic impacts to start occurring on the US portion of this watershed.
So here's a chance for you to put on your science hat. How does the dam at Lake Coconusa impact it? Does the selenium settle out into the sediment behind it, or does it stay suspended in the water and spill over top?
That's a really good question. And that's actually a question that a lot of state and federal entities are trying to answer. I know the USGS is working to get some data to understand kind of how selenium partitions between the water column and the sediment. And I believe that there is some data that shows there is a difference between the, I guess if you will, the top portion of the dam versus the bottom portion after it has been released from the dam. I'm sure mixing has a lot to do with that at the bottom of the dam, but those questions are still very much being tried to answer.
And then I have a question in the political realm, shifting from the science to the policy mm-hmm. portion, and either one of you feel free to chime in. If the source or origin are Canadian mines, I'm going to postulate we probably have less of a chance of impacting through legislation in Canada. Is it mostly spotlighting the issue to raise awareness, or are there things like the renegotiated Columbia Basin Treaty that can be brought to bear on it?
Sure, that's a great question. So right now, you're right, we have a little bit less leverage in doing anything in Canada, obviously, especially as a US NGO. However, there's something called the Boundary Waters Treaty, which was written in 1909, and it was developed essentially to prevent these types of transboundary water quality issues from occurring. And so the Boundary Waters Treaty essentially says that Canada can't pollute the US and vice versa, the US can't pollute Canada. And so in order to kind of initiate the Boundary Waters Treaty, what we have to do is we have to elevate this issue to the federal government, because they're going to be the ones that need to step in and kind of take the reins on holding Canada accountable. And so that's much of our focus right now, is elevating it to the federal level so that they can help us out here.
Okay, so you're raising awareness and you're poking or prodding the federal government to get going and start working on this issue before it becomes critical in the US.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and we've had some fairly good success with that. And I will say that that kind of goes back to the multi-layered issue with this. So that's our kind of overall push, is reaching that federal government. But there are also processes that are happening on the state level, like in Montana and Idaho, that we've been a part of to kind of place important stepping stones for the federal government to then be able to come in and use those stepping stones to hold Canada accountable.
So I'm assuming you're working with some colleagues too in the other states. There's a number of conservation groups in Montana that I imagine are interested in the issue.
Yes, absolutely. We work with people in Montana, and we also work very closely with an NGO in British Columbia called Wild Sites. They're kind of our counterpartner up there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's great that we've got you thinking about that issue, because that's a river that we all enjoy here in the region. And it's one of our closest trout fishing rivers for those of us who like to trout fish. And I'm one of them. So thank you. And another, we'll move to a little smaller issue, but big in our eyes. And that's the the ongoing questions about development along Trestle Creek. And that's impacting, hopefully not impacting, but possibly impacting Kokanee and bull trout, correct?
Right. So we've been working to raise awareness about it's the Idaho Club who has this proposed development on Trestle Creek. And that development has potential to cause further population decline of bull trout. So obviously we want to be very cautious about any developments going in on bull trout habitat. The Fish and Wildlife Service, the update we have on that is that the Fish and Wildlife Service, they should be making an announcement sometime this fall, we're hoping, about the status of that proposal and whether or not they're going to approve that development over at Trestle Creek. So still waiting to hear on that.
Okay. And if it does happen that they approve it, then ICL would have things to say.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. And again, I understand you're working with a number of partners, which is wonderful to see all of the interest in the impacts from potential developments across the lake in a number of areas, and that one being the prime one for some of the areas that ICL is concerned in. Tell us a little bit about upcoming opportunities for people to learn more or to engage in either or both of these issues.
Sure. So we have, since Ellie just talked about the Selenium webinar or the Selenium issue, we have a webinar coming up on Selenium, and that will be November 10th, and that's going to be with our WildSite partners that she mentioned, and also Calvin Sanborn, Ellie?
Yep.
Yeah,
so Calvin Sanborn is, I believe his official title is an attorney, and he works for the Environmental Law Center, which is in Victoria, Canada, and they're kind of act as this like environmental watchdog, if you will, for the environmental issues going on in Canada. And they recently released a report that kind of outlines the history of regulatory environmental negligence that has been put on by Canada over the last 20 or so years. And so this report really highlights how the lack of BC and Canada's ability to really constrain the selenium issue and prevent the pollution from impacting US waters. And so we're going to be hosting Calvin from the Environmental Law Center with WildSite to kind of talk about his report and just have him as a guest on our webinar.
Yeah. So anyone who wants to attend is welcome. It's open to the public, and you can register online on our website through our events page or through our Facebook, which is just Idaho Conservation League on Facebook.
Excellent. And before we started the broadcast, I think, Becca, you mentioned there was another webinar coming up at the end of October.
Yes, actually. So not in Sandpoint, but from our Ketchum office, they are going to be talking about the Snake River campaign and updates on that, as well as things that people can do to get involved to help this movement of trying to make the Snake River swimmable and fishable. So that'll be on October 28th, and that'll be at 6:30 Mountain Time.
What are some of the things being done or being proposed to be done to make it more swimmable and livable?
You'll have to tune into the webinar. I can't give that away. Josh Johnson, our conservation assistant down there, he will talk about that, as well as Stevie.
I know we're rolling into a time of year when activities generally quiet down, except for maybe around the holidays, and COVID has us all uncertain what's happening about those. But maybe tell us what you envision might be happening through the winter or next spring, what things might occur.
Sure. Yeah. So COVID has definitely changed things for ICL. We've been doing a lot of online engagement opportunities, but in the spring, something that we're exploring, which I'm super excited about and I think would be awesome, is doing a white bark pine planting over in the area of Trestle Creek that was impacted by wildfires. So something that Brad Smith, who's the North Idaho director, he's been talking about with the Forest Service, is getting potentially a grant to get some volunteers involved in planting seeds and seedlings of white bark pine in that area. And white bark pine is potentially going to be added to the endangered species list, I believe. There's been talk about that. So this effort could help with those recovery efforts.
Yeah. And white bark pine is a very important tree in the region. It's important to lots of plants and animals, other plants and animals and insects, correct? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's an exciting project. And it will be interesting, too, just to follow the general aftermath of the fire and see what it's done to the ecology of the landscape. It's a great transformative event. So do keep us apprised of that. And tell us a little bit about some of the other ways in which COVID's maybe impacted the winter and spring coming up.
Yeah, I think I can answer that. I think ICL in general historically has really focused our attention on making sure that our members and supporters and also just the general public are very much aware and in tune with our ongoing work and some of the other environmental issues that are going on in Idaho. And so usually the way we've gone about doing that is by hosting events and activities and hikes or any sort of, those group activities that obviously we haven't been able to do because of COVID. But I think that, we've really transitioned to a lot of webinars, and I think there's positive and negatives with that, but I think one really awesome thing is that we've been able to reach a much more broader audience when it comes to our webinars. Going back to the selenium issue, we can host a webinar in Sandpoint and still reach people in Montana and not have to have them drive 3 or 4 hours to get to our event at Matchwood or whatnot. So I think we've done okay adapting, and I can see that the webinars would even stick once we go back to whatever the new normal is.
Yeah, and specifically with this selenium webinar, it's going to be amazing to be able to partner with WildSight and get viewership from Canada, which is viewership that we need to raise awareness on. So Canada, Alaska, all of these transboundary states that are impacted by transboundary water quality issues.
I'd have to agree. I've listened in on at least one of your webinars, and it's helpful. For example, I probably wouldn't drive all the way down to Boise to hear about issues on the Snake River, but the webinars are just wonderful. You can sit in, ask questions, mm-hmm. et cetera. Yeah.
So as we kind of come to the close of all the formal questions we have, is there anything else you'd like to highlight about the work you're doing in the coming year, goals or objectives or long range plans?
Yeah, I think over the next year, we just hope to continue to reach out to a broader audience that might not be familiar with the conservation world, especially people who are kind of connected but not totally invested in conservation issues. So people who want to recreate on our lands but don't realize how conservation issues impact their ability to recreate on Idaho's public lands. And then especially tapping into issues that impact people on a local basis. So as individuals, as families, as neighborhoods, mentioned that one of the things I've been working on in North Idaho is clean energy. So things that impact individual communities, like working towards clean energy proposals in those cities and municipalities.
Yeah, that's great. And for folks wanting to know more or maybe looking for volunteer opportunities, what's the best way to get in contact with you all?
Yeah, you can go to our website, which is idahoconservationleague.org, and that has ways to get involved on our banner on the homepage. But also you can call us at ICL or email me. My email is on the website as well.
Okay, easy enough.
Very good. Very good. Any closing thoughts, Becca, while you're going? We'll start with you and then end with Ellie.
Yeah, well, thank you for having us on. It's been great to talk with you all this morning. And also just everyone, we'd love to see you on that webinar on November 10th to hear about Selenium and how you can get involved and how we can work towards those clean water quality issues in Montana and Idaho.
Yeah, I would ditto that and just say thanks to you guys for having us on. And it's nice to be a part of a great community here and look forward to learning more and more about the state.
Yeah, great. And I would like to thank you both and Idaho Conservation League for being underwriters here at KRFY. Yeah. We appreciate your support.
Thank you. Thank you both for coming on today. And if there's any programs that emerge or anything you want to highlight in the future, we often have short segments. So feel free to give us a jingle and we'll record a long form or short form interview and highlight whatever's coming up.
It is the perfect segue to end our interview today. And so I'll just go ahead and do that. I'm going to thank Ellie Hudson-Heck, Conservation Assistant, and Becca Rodak. You are the Community Engagement Assistant for Idaho Conservation League here in town, working in the Idaho Panhandle, for joining us this morning. It's been a great interview. It's great to learn about what ICL is doing here locally and also throughout the state. And we appreciate the work that you do. Thank you very much.